Yep.
Wing Commander Murray, Reel 1.
Whereabouts were you born, please?
Blandford, Dorset.
Which year was that?
And that was 31st of May, 1918.
What did your father do for a living?
My father, at that time, I think was still in the RAF. He'd been through the war, and in fact, he's one of the rare people who figured in all the service lists, the Navy, Army, and Air Force. But he helped form the accountancy section of the RAF when the RAF was formed from the RFC, which was about when I was born, I suppose, about 1918.
1st of April 1918.
Mm. Must have been nearly the same time. I forget when the RAF started. I think it was 1918.
Yes, the 1st of April.
1st of April, was it? Yeah. So he would have been in the RAF then at that time.
Did you go to school at Blandford?
No, we were only there 6 months. So I can't remember it, because he was moving around.
Where did you go to school?
Imperial Service College at Windsor.
And how old were you when you left?
Well, I went to the prep school at the age of just over 7, and I left to go to Cranwell at about 18, when I was 18, something rather.
So that must have been about 36 that you went to Cranwell?
Yeah.
What was the course like in those days?
It lasted 2 years. And I joined in January 36, and I left in December 37. Have I got the dates on that?
It doesn't matter about the exact dates, but... Mm. What was the course like?
Yes, I would have been commissioned on the 16th December 37, I suppose. Oh, it's so confusing, isn't it?
That's all right. Don't worry about the exact dates. It's just the approximate time you were at Cranwell.
Yes, it was 2 years.
Well, what did you think of the course?
I've got it here, actually. Thank goodness. January 37 to December 38 at Cranwell.
What did you think of the course there?
Well, of course, it was still... A lot of the previous war was still in it, if you see what I mean. We were still flying biplanes. We had a fairly high casualty rate, I would say. But it was a good grounding, it must have been. Unfortunately, I had a car accident in December of my third term. So a lot of that term I was out of action, and that rather set me back. Before that, I was being groomed for the Groves Memorial Flying Aerobatics Prize, but with the broken bones, of course. That took, you know, I got behind that. I had an advantage because my father, being in the Air Force, I started flying at RAF Halton when I was, I think, about 11 years old. So I went to Cranwell with the capability of going solo, although I had never been allowed to go solo.
Was it an enjoyable time for you at Cranwell or not?
On the whole, yes, I think. I got a bit disillusioned with it because, you know, by the time we've gone through a fairly tough prep school, and the public school, which was a service, you know, empire orientated, you have all this going from the fag up to prefect, then at prep school, then the same thing at public school, and then having to start at the bottom again at Cranwell, I just didn't want to believe it anymore, you know. So I felt a little bit jaundiced about all that sort of side of it.
But there wasn't a fagging system.
Oh no, but I mean, you were a bog rat. You know, you were bullied. You know, you had various sort of introductory
initiation.
Rag, the initiations and things.
Did that consist of?
Oh, being chucked up in blankets and having to creep for Jesus or something. I can't remember what they were all about now, but they're all supposed to be degrading to put you in your place. And to have it the third time, Ryan, it wasn't really working.
So, what was your first operational squadron?
My first... I was the first... 49 Squadron was my first squadron. And I was the first replacement. When the war broke out, I was in 106 Squadron, which had just converted from battles onto Manchester's. And then it was broken up because it wasn't operational. And I joined 49 Squadron at Scampton about 3 weeks after the outbreak to replace their first casualty. And the reason he was a casualty was because the station commander, whose name I can't remember and wouldn't quote anyway probably, said that he wanted some of the spirit of the RSC, things like spinning your wheels on the mess roof, you know. And of course this chap tried to do it in an Anson without much success. So that's how I arrived at 49 Squadron.
What was the atmosphere in the squadron when you arrived?
It was pretty good. I mean, nothing very much was happening at the time. And we all felt that we had a job that we'd been trained to do, and we were, you know, although we were hopelessly under-trained, really, we were keen to do it. Particularly for Cranmore people like myself, you know, we were, that's what we were for, we were professionals.
What was the equipment of the squadron when you arrived?
We had Hamdens.
What was it like to fly the Hamden?
It had quite a few vices, actually, which took, I can't really remember whether it was 106 or 49 at the various things. We had a lot of oiling up of the lower pistons whilst we were idling to take off. And this is because the RAF really had been flying on liquid-cooled inline engines and weren't used to cylinders. So we used to get a number of engine failures. There was design fault in the tail unit in that it was a balanced rudder, and if on the approach you didn't fly it very accurately and it was too flat, this thing could lock over into the full rudder situation and then sort of go into the ground. But if you flew it accurately, it was perfectly all right.
What about the leadership and personnel in the squadron at that time?
They were all right, I suppose. The flight commanders were good pilots. The squadron commander tended to be a bit of a sort of has-been and, you know, not operational in that sense. He flew the aeroplanes, but, you know. But I wouldn't like to say more than that if this is being recorded. But I think the squadron commanders had a difficult job because they were, you know, trying to sort out what the war was going to be like.
What kind of duties did the squadron have in that period of what became known as the Phoney War?
Our first operations were dropping leaflets along the Sylt, you know, the German coast, which was pretty ineffective. And that was my first operation. And then after that, there were problems with the pocket battleships. And we were placed under the control of the Navy and sent up to Kinloss. And that was in a winter period, I suppose it'd be around about January. And they tried to, the Navy was not expert in looking after aeroplanes, and they, I suppose they wanted to push their weight a bit, but they had us doing fighter standby, sitting in our aircraft on immediate readiness for hours on end, which didn't do our health much good. I remember I got flu, and I still sat in the damn aeroplane because we were very keen to do any fighting that had to be done.
That was a very cold winter.
And it was a very cold winter. Mm. And we were sat in the, as I say, in the Hamdens for hours on end, about 5 hours at a time, probably.
How did you feel about conducting leaflet raids over Germany?
Well, it was exciting because we didn't know if we were going to be shot at, and it was our first experience of operations. So the flying side was interesting. It was educative in terms of, you know, knowing how to operate. Of course, we thought the idea of the leaflets was ridiculous, frankly. But I mean, that didn't affect our operations. It was an experience. Had its training value, I suppose.
You say you were standing by on behalf of the Royal Navy.
Robert Devonton.
Did you actually go out to hunt the pocket battleships?
We did on one occasion. I think I call them Norwegian Fiasco. And we sent, we weren't based up at Scotland at that time, we operated from Scampton. And there had been a reporting of one of them going up the Norwegian coast. And so we set off with the two Scampton squadrons in Vic line abreast, assuming the V's, Vic's line abreast, and charged off to the southern Stavanger area, I suppose, looking for this battleship armed with 500-pound bombs, which wouldn't have done much good. We never fired it, but and of course we had no intercommunication, there was no RT. We devised the sort of thing, whether we opened the top hatch and sort of sent coded letters to each other, so it's pretty
with your hands.
And I remember there was something which even to me looked like a battleship, and we all roared towards this thing, the bomb doors open and everything. And it just turned out to be a lighthouse on a low-lying island. So we roared over this thing. Then the weather started getting bad, and we flew up hugging the coast with low cloud, and we were hugging this coast, and suddenly I looked at the other side, and there was coast the other side. So we were flying up a field. About 400-500 feet underneath low stratus. And of course, we came to the end of the field, and there was no way of turning this vast, unwieldy formation. So we did what the mass bands do at Olympia, you know, we turned back inside each other and managed to get out of that without anyone scraping a mountain. And then we set back after that, trying to get to Kinloss, to Scotland. And it went on and on and on because the headwind was very strong. And in my squadron commander's aircraft, we had a naval lieutenant who was going to be an advisor on, you know, on the battleship, I suppose. And he realized something was wrong. And he said, we're missing Scotland. We're flying to the north of it. Because those are Atlantic rollers, I recognize them. So with that, Brownspeed Lewis, I think we used to call him, he turned southwest, which was a sort of a compromise. And the other squadron went straight on. The weather was pretty awful by then. And we found a trawler and started circling around this thing. And the squadron commander had the idea that he'd fly very slowly past it, drop a crew member out, who'd then clamber aboard and point towards land. So, just shows you what the beginning of the war was like, doesn't it? But anyway, we were circling round this thing, getting very low in fuel. And I noticed in the haze, it was by then sort of very thick, sunny haze, you know, the front had obviously gone through. There was a bit of land. So, and also I noticed, before I noticed the land, I noticed the number of aircraft circling around was getting fewer and fewer. Because they'd seen this land. And eventually we all landed at Accrington, except for one who ran out of fuel on the approach and was lost.
That's Northumberland.
And that's in Northumberland. And this was sort of Holy Island, you know, the Farne Islands or whatever they are, you know. Holy Loch or something. No, Holy Island.
Holy Island.
Mm, all that.
About...
Well, the other squadron went straight on and into the Firth of Forth, were intercepted by one of the auxiliary fighter squadrons, and two of them, at least two, were shot down. And a friend of mine, he was shot down, was in the water, and the fisherman, he tried to get on a fishing boat which came towards him, and the fisherman got the oars and said, "Get off the boat, you bloody hound." And they were trying to prevent him getting on this on this fishing boat, till he shouted at them with a few, you know, pithy expletives, and they realised that he wasn't German.
What time of year was this then? What season? Was it sound like summer, from if you were talking about here?
I should think it was early summer.
Of 1940?
Of 1940. I must have it in here somewhere.
Did you take part in the actual Norway campaign?
Yes. That, I suppose, was quite an interesting... They invaded, if you remember, the Germans filled up merchant ships as troop carriers and suddenly arrived at Oslo. And we flew in a night operation with mines to drop them from underneath these troop carriers. And there's a long field going up into Oslo. And we were going as low as we could up the field. And I don't know if you can imagine what it's like, but we had searchlights shining down on us. So it's very confusing. I was second pilot, and I was sitting in the nose, the bomb aimer's position at the time. And a tracer bullet went through the perspex nose canopy. And it must have gone underneath my nose, because I sat in the aircraft afterwards and took up the same position. And it went out the other side. My mouth was full of dust and, you know, stink of whatever it is traces are made of, you know. So that's fairly close. We carried on and got into the harbour, and I saw right ahead of me, above me, the masts of one of these merchant ships. And let the mine go, and screen to skin Forsyth, my pilot and captain, to climb, you know, because he could hardly see anything. And we just missed this merchant vessel, you know, two masts and chimney and this thing. And I remember saying, climb for parachute height, because I didn't think there was any way we'd get out of all this mayhem going on. And suddenly all was quiet, and there's another little fjord going down the other way, and we came out that way.
So you'd gone in to attack the German ships invading Norway?
That, I think, was the night after they'd invaded, yes. I think it was literally the night following reports that they'd gone in there. But whether we sunk in here, no idea. But I don't suppose that, you know, the intelligence wasn't available at the time. But I could have easily hit, with my mine, it could have actually hit the side of the thing and broken up, but because we are pretty close to it at the time.
Any other actions in the Norway campaign?
Not with 49 Squadron, I don't think.
You left 49 Squadron in 1940, according to your record here.
Yeah.
Do you remember when in 1940 that was?
Yes, it was the 25th. Of the 9th of September of 40.
What about the campaign in France and the Low Countries? Did you take part in that?
Well, yes, I think you've got the record. I think I did 39 operations on that tour altogether, which was, they hadn't invented tours, you see. And it's quite funny. We did a lot of flying Berlin over. I remember flying over Paris during the beginning of the German advance. Hopelessly lost. The lovely sight. It was burning. But you saw all the bridges and everything in the firelight. It was a beautiful sight, but horrific, of course. And we did operations bombing the barges on the coast, which had troops in them before the invasion. In August 1940, they suddenly invented the tour system and told us that we were tour expired and we finished our operations. That was actually, we actually mutinied. We refused to go. And, you know, we were all posted to OTUs, training units.
Because you wanted to continue operating?
Well, it was our war and we didn't see why we should we wouldn't go on till the end. Whether it was our end or the war's end, that's the spirit of those days, obviously. So they sent us on what they called tired crew leave. This was about five of us, I suppose, which we gratefully took 3 weeks in August. Suddenly we were pretty tired at the time. And whilst we were away, they packed all our bags up and sent it down to the units to which they'd posted us. So when we got back to Scampton, there was no way but to be put into a truck and sent down to, in my case, Cottesmore.
So it sounds as though morale was very high.
It was exceptionally high, I think, during that period.
In spite of all the setbacks.
Yes, we'd yes, oh yes, because we weren't all that. You see, we learnt things very quickly. You see, that Norwegian fiasco just fiasco shows how. What a state we were in at that time. But as we progressed, then we got more efficient. I did quite a lot of trips to Berlin in June. And we found the place and bombed it. And I think we were pretty good. But by God, to sit in the Hamden's only a yard wide, and you sat on a pilot's type parachute. And it was pretty, take 8 hours of flying, probably, those Berlin trips. 7 to 8 hours, or over 8 hours. And I remember, towards the end of June, getting out of the aircraft, and I just couldn't stand. I rolled down the wing like a dead spider, with all the limbs crunched up, giggling. Because it was wonderful to be back.
What kind of targets were you bombing in Berlin?
I can't remember. I think this was my first... this was April. It was after the... No, this was about it. Operations Recco, Minebed, North Silt. That was the 1st of April. Then there was, these were Hamdens, of course. Operation Security Patrol and Recco, North Silt approaches. I don't know what they meant. And this, to me, is an interesting one. On the 11th of April, Operations Middelfart, Mine Lane. That's in the Little Belt of Denmark. This was the first time mines were dropped in the war. And my flight commander was detailed to drop the first one. He took off 10 minutes ahead of me. And I was determined to beat him, and I actually did beat him. So I dropped the first mine in the war. And it was a place called Middelfart, a name I always remember. Underneath, at the edge of a bridge there. And some time later, we got an actual photograph of a merchantman on its, you know, its sunker ship. It was on its side.